You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Have you ever wondered what those bright squiggly graffiti marks on the sidewalk mean? Or stopped to consider why you don't see metal fire escapes on new buildings? Or pondered the story behind those dancing inflatable figures in car dealerships? One podcast shines a light on those overlooked elements in the built environment, and it also happens to be one of my personal favorites that I listen to every week. 99% Invisible is a big ideas podcast about small-seeming things, revealing stories baked into the buildings we inhabit, the streets we drive, and the sidewalks we traverse. The show celebrates design and architecture in all of its functional glory and accidental absurdity, with intriguing tales of both designers and the people impacted by their designs. Now, in a new book titled The 99% Invisible City, a field guide to the hidden world of everyday design, 99PI host Roman Mars and co-author Kurt Kohlstedt zoom in on the various elements that make our cities work, exploring the origins and other fascinating stories behind everything from power grids and fire escapes to drinking fountains and street signs. And today I'm happy to welcome Roman back to the show to reveal why it's taken him a decade to finally write a 99% Invisible book, all of the thought that this design fan put into the look of his first book, and some of the secret publishing considerations that determine everything from how many units get returned to whether or not a book gets sold by Costco. We talk about the baseball player who outlasted his sell-by date and became synonymous with stairs to nowhere and other useless architectural elements, how the lost art of neon tube bending is making a comeback, and how residents, local governments, and more impact the look and character of a neighborhood. For instance, Roman shares how taxes have played a role in the shape of buildings throughout history and the role that design plays in making our public spaces safer and our cities more pedestrian-friendly during the current pandemic. Plus, we talk about creepy dolls, librarians on a power trip, hideous city flags, and San Francisco's love-hate relationship with the Transamerica Pyramid. Coming up with 99% Invisible's Roman Mars in just a moment. Roman Mars is creator and host of 99% Invisible, the wildly popular podcast exploring architecture and design, for which he produced the most successful crowdfunding campaigns for a podcast in Kickstarter history. Fast Company named Mars one of the 100 most creative people in 2013, and he was a TED main stage speaker in 2015. Now, at long last, he's come out with a wonderful new book titled The 99% Invisible City, a field guide to the hidden world of everyday design. Roman Mars, congrats on the book and welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be back.
Well, since we last spoke, there's one thing that I've been wondering about. You have an unusual name. I don't meet a lot of Marses out there. Are you by any chance any relation to Franklin and Forrest Mars of the Mars Candy Empire, the guys who created M&Ms and Mars Bar, of course?
I wish I could say I was, and life would be a whole lot easier if that were the case, but that is not the case.
Okay.
No, sorry.
I just had to ask, you know, that candy money, man.
That candy money, that's a private, I mean, I've followed them for a long time, obviously.
Yeah.
And that's a private company owned by a family, and that is not my family.
Oh, okay. Okay. By the way, I love that you've continued the tradition of bold names in your family with your sons, Maslow Rocket Mars and Carver Atomic Mars. I'm assuming those names were all you, or did your wife give you any pushback at first on those?
Oh, not at all. No, their mom, like, picked out, was instrumental in picking out those names.
Oh, really?
They were definitely part of her invention. Even more, we sort of settled on the first names to kind of together, and then I think we were brainstorming different parts of making the middle name really exciting for them to choose to go with later on in life. But yeah, that's true.
Now, for anyone who has never listened to your podcast, 99% Invisible, and I certainly encourage them to do so, it's just wonderful. Could you explain the mission statement behind 99PI?
Well, it's a show about design, but in the broadest sense possible. It's really the story of, you know, why things are the way they are, and it's using the built world or just any sort of built concept or anything designed to tell us who we are as humans, like through the things that we make. And so it's just sort of follows our curiosity, but it often takes the form of, you know, looking at bridges and buildings and intersections and things like that. We like to focus on the mundane and try to tell you the most interesting story about mundane things.
Yeah, you do define design fairly broadly. It makes me think of your latest episode, which is about the woman who founded the children's reading room at the New York Public Library. I just love that. Yeah. I was just listening to it this morning. And it's interesting to think that there was a time when libraries not only didn't cater to kids, but pretty much banned them from coming in.
Yeah. They didn't understand why you would invest energy in the sort of cognitive life of a child. You know, like they just really didn't. There was just a different view of childhood. Yeah. And so this woman, Ann Carol Moore, really, you know, changed that, like, you know, almost single-handedly, and like pushed all this stuff and forward into the world. And it and now, I mean, I think people think of the children's section of the library as almost the primary part of the library because of her.
I'm one of those people who gets excited every time I stumble on one of the original Carnegie libraries, wherever I am. I don't know about you. You probably do the same thing, but I would bet that none of those had a children's section when they were first opened.
Nope. They did not. They did not. I mean, I think people try different things. I mean, there tends to be, like, since we tell a lot of origin stories, one of the things you learn when you tell origin stories is that origin stories are never quite as clean as they tend to be presented. So there's, you know, when you have libraries everywhere, there is undoubtedly some librarian in some corner of, you know, St. Louis or, you know, like Jefferson City or whatever, who has decided, you know, like to put together a little children's corner. Yeah. And it, you know, never went anywhere. But yeah, so it's very likely there were nothing until Ann Carol Moore. But it's also possible that there were occasional, you know, children's parts of other libraries, depending on who was there.
But I love that episode because she starts out trying to offer immigrants and poor kids a chance to read books. And then she becomes this huge influence in the children's publishing world and eventually kind of goes a little bit power mad by the end of it. I have to ask you to tell this story of this strange kind of story within a story, really, in the podcast about the doll she used to carry around. It's just too bizarre for me not to bring that up here.
Yeah, so one of the things that happened is, you know, she's basically the inventor of the children's section of the library, you know, really, you know, came to the New York Public Library and created this. And but she had really specific tastes. I mean, she was sort of a person who was really working towards something, a vision that she had in mind for what a children's library should be. And that included not including a lot of books that had real world problems and things to do with cities. She really liked the sort of pastoral imaginative settings of like Winnie the Pooh and things like that. But things that involve cities and grittiness, she was not a fan of. And so she ended up, you know, banning those. And because she has so much influence, you know, a lot of libraries around the country also didn't stock those books until, you know, later on in her life, and her, you know, her grip on the children's publishing world, you know, loosened. Did books like Goodnight Moon and Where the Wild Things Are and, you know, things like that become more of what we think of as children's literature. But she also had her own quirks, which were she had this wooden doll that she carried around called Nicholas Knickerbocker, who was ostensibly there to encourage the kids to, you know, engage with her and not be shy and be part of the library, but she also carried her around like all the time and you know, it kind of forced her employees to talk to her through the doll. And if there was something that upset her, she would say stuff like Nicholas Knickerbocker doesn't like the sound of that and things like this. And so she had these sort of, you know, like even though she was groundbreaking, and I think she did, I come on the side that she did way more good than harm in this world. you know, she had her little moments of tyranny that were pretty off-putting for a lot of people, for sure.
Yeah, I think that you said that big authors like Beatrix Potter would write notes to Nicholas and like kind of pitch things to Nicholas, sort of.
You had to buy into this fantasy of her because, you know, because there wasn't a huge, you know, even bookstore, you know, scene, like there wasn't nationalized bookstores like B. Dalton's and Walden Books. This is, you know, predates that. So like the children's library as she built it was the main buyer of children's books, you know, during this time period. And so she had so much influence on the market that you presented your book to her to see if she accepted it because it meant whether you sold them or not to the rest of the country. And so, you know, there was a certain amount of fealty that was required. And so Beatrix Potter, you know, may have just loved her and loved the doll and loved all this stuff. But you can't deny that she also kind of had to do that sort of stuff politically to get accepted.
And I don't know if this is from your podcast or where I'm getting this from, but I want to say that it reminds me of a story of a guy in Manhattan in the 30s and 40s who used to carry a mannequin around with him everywhere he went. He would, you know, get a booth and sit there with his mannequin and talk to her. And all. Was that an episode you guys from, did?
We did an episode called Mannequin Pixie Dream Girl. It was by the same reporter, producer, Joe Rosenberg. And so he delights in those particular stories. But yeah, it was another sort of situation where a lot of people like played into this fantasy and you know, like didn't know how to tell him no.
Well, I want to say, wasn't there a movie like that with Kim Cattrall? I think it was called Mannequin, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. No, there was that. And then the more modern day reference is like Lars and the Real Girl, where he's in love with a blow up doll too. But there's a bit of a history of this, but it is decidedly weird for sure.
Well, I want to talk about this wonderful new book that you just put out, The 99% Invisible City. This is coming out, I want to say it's around the 10-year anniversary of the start of your podcast. I'm kind of surprised that it's taken so long for you to do a 99PI book. I'm sure you must have had offers from publishers for years now. Why the long wait and why now?
I mean, it really started from the beginning. I mean, the main thing was that we weren't ready. I mean, I wasn't ready. The show takes up a ton of time, you know, like, and a book is a really big project. But also, you know, like, we do a show about design. I'm really design-minded in sort of every respect. And I needed there to be a reason for it to be a book. Like, I made a podcast. A podcast doesn't necessarily need to be a book. So it needed a reason. And what ended up happening was, you know, we reached this threshold where, you know, I've now done 415 episodes of the show, and there's all this information and sort of a worldview built in of how to, you know, like how to take in the city, take in the world, how to examine things closely, how to think and be curious and ask questions. And they're kind of locked up in this, you know, audio linear format that, you know, I don't know if it's really easy to revisit. So like, for example, if you had a question about, you know, the mannequin guy or like curb cuts or fire escapes, you'd have to remember like what year did that episode come out?
Right.
What was it called? Because I probably didn't call it just fire escapes. I probably named it something clever at the time, but now it's completely obfuscated to go search for it. And there's sort of like all this information is sort of locked up. And I really wanted this idea of like a field guide to tell a way to tell the story in these fun essays that you could look through, leaf through, find your own way, you know, use it as a guide to the city. Yeah. And it's a guide to any city, but it uses examples from all over the world. But the idea is, you know, if you're interested in the streetlight at your corner, we'll tell you a story about the most interesting streetlight that we know of, which is the one in Syracuse, New York. We're not going to tell you about the one in your corner. We don't know what your corner is, but, and so there was like, there became to be a reason for it to exist. And that was really it. And, you know, at 10 years, it seemed to make sense to like reach out. We, you know, like as you're a longtime listener, and there's a way that we kind of own a way of thinking in a certain subject. So if there's a thing about flags in the world, like I get sent it. If there's a thing about challenge coins, I get sent information about it. There's like a thing that and I just wanted to sort of like expand that worldview to people who have never heard a podcast. You know, there's still like 75% of the world who's never turned on a podcast, and a book makes sense for them. And so it was kind of a little bit of an outreach, a little bit of a compendium a little bit of like how to, you know, do something to celebrate doing this for 10 years and a new challenge. And also, you know, Kurt Kohlstedt, who's the co-author of the book, you know, like he had the verve and drive and he really pushed it forward. And I could have never done it on my own. That's mm-hmm. for sure. And it's also kind of this delight to make a thing in the world, you know, like it's a beautiful object. It has great illustrations and stuff. And it just was, all of it sort of came together at the right time. And in any time before this would never have done it. It just wasn't right.
Particularly for you, it must be pleasing to finally have created something that you can hold in your hands. You know, podcasts are so ephemeral, you know, but to be able to leaf through it and put it on your bookshelf for forever and wonder 50 years from now, where will that book be? Will it be in someone's library, in a resale shop? Who knows? Who will pick that up?
Hasn't really hit me yet what that means, because I am a lover of books, and it's been so... When you're involved in a project, it's so hard to do the project that you just kind of begin to like almost resent every part of it. And I was looking at it the other day I was kind of delighted at just what it looked like and what it felt like and stuff like that, and remembering what it was all for. And so this is the time period where it feels kind of nice. But I assure you, every moment up to this point in the book has been pretty tough.
I love that you didn't just cash in on your following and just throw anything out there. I mean, this book is packed full of things that fans of the show will appreciate, from the wonderful artwork to the reference to quote unquote beautiful downtown Oakland where you record the podcast. Every page of this book is very much imbued with the spirit of 99PI.
Yeah, we definitely did not want it to be. I mean, in the very beginning, the first thing that was offered to me in terms of books was just like make transcripts available of the show, or like loosely, you know, prosify transcripts. And I was like, I don't want to be associated with things like that. Like, I need it to be good. And so like, it is a real book. It is dense. It has tons of stories that are not from the show. Everything that is from the show is like, there's only like it's kind of like 50-50. There's like 50% new stuff and 50% that has some source in the show, but every bit of it that's even sourced from the show is like re-researched and represented in a new way. And it's also written completely differently, because when you write for the page and you write for your voice, it's just totally different. So, and then all the images and stuff, like it's a real book. It's a lovely thing. Even the thing, when we first got the layout back, Kurt and I were looking at it and I was like, the index is beautiful, isn't it? Like, yeah, the index really looks good. Like, it's formatted beautifully. Like, there are things like this that I kind of love, and there's little secrets in the designs that people can find that are fun too. So it's a book. It's really is a book. It's a product of its own thing.
I have to say, I absolutely love the cover of the book. And I don't know if I'm giving away one of these little secrets that you mentioned, but even the dust cover, it sort of serves as a field guide to the cover art. There's a field guide within the field
guide. That's right. That was one of our big, you know, like surprises and fun things to figure out, was how to make something kind of delightful that was in the spirit of the book immediately on the cover. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm assuming that the aesthetic of the book was very important to you. How much time did you spend figuring out what the book was going to look like?
Like a ton. like I can't even like I'll quantify bet. It.
It's probably
like,
more time than writing. I don't know.
I mean, it was just one of those things that there were spreadsheets. Like Kurt was not only the co-author, but he was like the project manager. And so like he was like every essay was like, what requires an illustration? Why is it what style? Where is it gonna fit? You know, like what are we gonna do about the cover? We talked about the cover a lot. Raphael Gironi designed the cover, designed the book, and Patrick Vale did the illustrations, and they all came together to create something kind of amazing. And the original idea was to maybe do the 99% Invisible logo is a grid with a yellow square, was just sort of make a completely covered dust jacket, and then you would only see one little portion of it, like 1% would be visible. But that was considered a little too cryptic, and full dust jackets, you know, tear, you know, there were things to learn about the book industry that we didn't know, you know, and we were like, well, it'll be die cut and it'll be like this. And HMH, the publisher, was like, yeah, but if we do that, we're going to get back about 5% because a book with a torn cover isn't going to be sold. And, you know, things like this is just like,
oh, wow. I never thought of that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's the thing you have to think about. And then the size, we always knew we wanted to be slightly off size. Like it wasn't exactly, normal hardback book. It's a little bit wider, a little bit bigger. But within reason, and there's things like, well, Costco can't they won't lay the book down if it isn't like kind of within these parameters and things like this. So you just like,
really?
You have no idea.
Wow.
And these are the type, because, you know, like I'm a design nerd and I love the hidden stories of things. Even the sort of hidden story of what makes it, you know, required, what are the dimensions required so that Costco will buy your book and stock it is interesting to me.
Yeah.
So we went through all that stuff. It was one of those things that never seemed to stop. And we still find things that we want to shift and change. It's just one of those things. But yeah, there was a ton of effort into all that.
Yeah, you could do a whole podcast just on that. I wonder, sure, what would you have said if the editors at Houghton Mifflin said, you know, I don't know, let's just slap a grinny photo of you on the cover here. Would that have been a deal breaker?
I mean, for sure. I mean, luckily, they always went into this with, you know, like, there's a certain point, like every contract, if you read a book contract, it is not like in the author's favor at all. Like it is not, you're basically selling yourself away. And so they could have easily done that. Like it was within their rights to put a picture of me on the cover. It just so happened that they were always collaborative. Like they treated it as if we had veto power that we actually, I don't think we truly had, to tell you the truth. So
we're going to take a quick break and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment.
And many of the stories in 99% Invisible City, or the 99% Invisible City, will be familiar to listeners of the show. One old favorite of mine is Thomason's.
Mm-hmm.
Now, almost everyone listening has probably seen a Thomason when they're walking around their neighborhood or going into the city, and they don't even realize it, or at least they don't know that there's an actual name for these things. Mm-hmm. Explain what a Thomason is.
A Thomason is a little like vestigial piece of a city. So something that's unused, you know, like a leftover mailbox that no longer takes mail, or a piece of railing, like the quintessential example that the artist Akasegawa Genpei, like, found was a staircase that went up to the side of a building, had a landing, then went back down. And at the landing, you would expect a door, but that door was long gone. But the staircase was still there. And it's not just that the staircase was still there, it's that the staircase was still maintained. Like the railing was repainted recently. And he was just fascinated by something that was useless but maintained. And he began looking for them all over the city, and then like opening it up. He was part of a photographic magazine, and they would take pictures of them, and people would send in their Thomasons, and he named them Thomasons. And the reason why he named them Thomasons was that he was a baseball fan, and there was an American baseball player named Gary Thomason, and he played here for the San Francisco Giants in the Bay Area, where I'm from. And he had, later on in his career, he began to play for the Yomiuri Giants in Japan, and he was a very expensive American baseball player that did not perform well as soon as he came to Japan. So he was, he drew this metaphor of this very expensive, well-maintained player who was functionally useless on the baseball team. And he called these things in the cities, he called them Thomasons. And so, we heard this story, was so totally intrigued by it, and represented it and talked to the translator and different people to talk about Thomasons. And I think Thomasons are, I mean, it sounds like a dig. I totally understand why some, you know, like the, you know, Thomason wouldn't necessarily be like in love with this idea of being
right.
named after this thing. However, these are kind of delightful, you know, things to find in a city. They're ways to be engaged. They're, mm-hmm. they're kind of a form of art in the city that exists. And mm-hmm. having an eponym for something that really does give people joy is something that I hope that the people who know Thomason or knew Thomason would accept as a compliment.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, sometimes I've seen stairs that go to nowhere. The door has just been bricked over, or the kind of the opposite. You'll see, you know, a second story door, but no stairs leading down.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of thing. Yeah. And those things are super fun. And the reason why I like them is I like for us to take in the city as a whole, both as a designed object and also this accidental accumulation of different decisions mm-hmm. that all kind of interact with each other. And it's just sort of like seeing all that complexity, seeing all those weird choices and how they represent our values at different times, just makes the city come alive to me in a cool way. And so, like, rather than be annoyed or, I don't know, or think, oh, that's dumb. Why does that stairway go up there and there's no door? Just take a moment to just like take some delight in the ridiculousness of it and go like, oh yeah, we're humans. We're ridiculous. And things change over time and we're doing our best. And sometimes we paint a railing to stairs that go nowhere. And that's part of the human condition too.
Yeah, that's one thing that comes up a lot on your podcast is how some of these more overlooked things in the built environment, such as Thomason's, get left behind as a neighborhood changes, and also just how design and or discarded design act as indicators of the socioeconomic status of a particular area. And it makes me think of a particular chapter in here on tube benders, which is not something that you get during rough sex or something. It's the lost art of making neon signs.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because neon, at their best, they bring about this warm sense of nostalgia if you see a coffee shop or maybe an old Cadillac dealership. But it can also be a sign, literally and figuratively, of a neighborhood that's in decline. You know, when we're watching a movie and there's an old neon sign flickering on and off, or it has a letter that's busted out, it's usually accompanied by an ominous sense that someone's going to get jumped or stumble over a dead body.
That's right.
Usually never a good thing, is it?
No, I mean, today especially, I mean, there was a time where neon was huge. I mean, it represented, like this, it represented the forefront of like fashion and technology, and it was a literal sign of something fancy happening. And there were streets like Market Street in San Francisco before BART came in, and they ripped up the street to create the BART line underground, and in that process they took down all these overhanging neon signs. Market Street in San Francisco looked like Las Vegas. I mean, it was just of the time. This was a big deal of showing off what a fancy establishment you had. And like anything that's fashionable, over time, when fashions change and things, are left over, those are the older parts of town. And then the other thing that happened with neon in particular is that it's fragile, like it's a glass tube with a gas in it, and it's, excited by electricity. And so if you, if one goes out, then all of a sudden it costs hundreds of dollars to fix. People don't have the money to fix it. And it really shows its age and its wear a little too much. Mm-hmm. And so it's often an indicator of other things. But then, there's moments where it's done really well. And I think neon is actually sort of reaching a new resurgence. Like if you look at startups in the Bay Area in the past few years, including like our show, like they have customized neon signs they put in their headquarters because it has a little bit of flair of nostalgia. It has something cool and novel, and there's a artistic quality to it. So it's more niche and artistic than it was, but now it sort of indicates fanciness again. And these things are all cycles.
So you have a neon sign for 99% Invisible or for Radiotopia?
For
what does something like that cost? Just out of curiosity.
You know, we got an extremely good deal because we were doing the show on neon signs, and one of the people we talked to after we were all done was like, hey, would you like a neon sign? And I was like, yes, please. And so we basically paid, the wholesale, just basically cost price. And she came in and made us say we in the very first fund, the early fundraisers for the show, we made these challenge coins, and it's the symbol of one of the it's the first challenge coin. It's a neon sign of it, and it hangs in the entrance to our office, and it's really beautiful. I just love it.
And you also talk about design and how it plays into the identity of neighborhoods and how those form and change over years. Most neighborhood identities evolve gradually as a reflection of the people who live there, but then it can also come from a more organized gentrification effort, or even sometimes local governments try to impose an identity from the top down. You have a chapter in here on that. Talk about some examples of that, and does it usually work, or do residents tend to resist that kind of thing?
Well, it depends. I mean, really, it's sort of like, the thing is like what makes the character of a city is all those things. It's a lot of top down. It's a lot of bottom up. And what makes a city is that conversation back and forth with people making interventions on their own behalf, like guerrilla interventions in the city to make something the way they are. And then lots of planning from above, and it's always a push and pull. And one of the things that I think when people cover design in the broad sense, like they would think about a big office building or a tower changing the character of a city, an architect having a lot of influence on how a city is perceived. And I get that. But I also think that, you know, a person opening up a store in a neighborhood changes the city as much as any architect ever could. Mm-hmm. And so it's really all that stuff together that is, you know, what makes a city what it is. And in particular, the current sort of thing that people fight about a lot is sort of tactical urbanism. That's where people are, you know, putting in bike lanes that aren't there, you know, because they want to make the city more suitable to their needs. Right. And I think that we've overvalued cars in cities, and I agree with that, you know. And then occasionally those bike lanes are adopted by the city itself. Like, they realize that this is valuable and it's important. It serves their constituency, and so it's worth it. But doing that from the top down is almost impossible. And so that conversation and all the messiness is what makes a city a city. And that's why it's endless, why you can write about it endlessly.
Yeah, and that's a very timely topic because, you know, here in California, cities are closing some traffic lanes to provide more outdoor seating for restaurants during the pandemic. Cities like New York have closed down entire thoroughfares like Madison Avenue to allow pedestrians more room for social distancing.
I agree. I mean, when there's these moments of crisis and people can see the ability to change and the need to change, people get more of an ability to experiment, or they have more capacity to experiment, more willingness to experiment. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I, you know, like, you know, we obviously never planned for this book 2 years ago to reach an audience, you know, today during a, you know, pandemic and wildfires and all these things. But one of the things that is clear is that it's an interesting time to examine how we got to now when it comes to cities, mm-hmm. right at this moment when people are experimenting with cities in all these different types of ways and all these sort of like light architecture changes, like tape on the floor to indicate where people should stand and maybe at first it was just tape and then yeah. it was like these, you know, like designed, you know, like little things with feet on them and signs and they have messages on them and they've evolved into that. And the plexiglass, you know, between you and the register, that came up really, really fast, like within a week or something, I started seeing that. And, you know, yeah. sometimes when we look at our city, we have a very solipsistic view of the world. You know, we think the city is as it was when we entered into it, and it probably should always stay that way, you know, the way we're used to. And so when you see these moments of change, it's an interesting time to go like, wait a minute, if that has changed, when did we get this thing too? You know, like why, you know, like if you can close down a street to make it all like outdoor seating, why did we ever think that streets, you know, why did streets become car only at a certain point? Because that happened. That wasn't mm-hmm. like a thing that happened in the beginning. In the beginning, streets were this completely mix of like pedestrians and horses and carts and vendors and everything. And you navigated the street and it was dangerous and it was weird, but nothing went fast enough for it to be like a huge problem. And then cars came on and then they just said, this is mine. You know, like cars were just like, roads are mine. And yeah. the thing was, is that was a choice. That wasn't inevitable. That wasn't just like a thing that just happened. And it wasn't always the way it was. And so when you have these moments mm-hmm. where you take part of the road back because there is a need for people to sit outside, you can look at all that stuff and realize that these are all choices. They're choices that we can examine again, decide what our priorities are today. And that, you know, that thought process is valuable. You know, like not accepting the status quo as is a valuable thing. Even if you in the end decide that roads should stay the way they are and they need to have cars or whatever it is, at least you thought about it. And that's what, like, our show is really all about, thinking yeah. about those things. And this moment when there's all this change, it's a really interesting time to think about those things again.
Yeah, it makes me think of, what was his name? I want to say Gridlock Sam in New York, who was this guy who for years was pushing to make it a more pedestrian-friendly city, yet he was up against these massive forces, you know, like guys like Robert Moses, who was determined to force Manhattan to become a driver's city. I mean, he wanted to bulldoze Washington Square to create an expressway.
Totally.
And he really had the odds against him.
And absolutely. And Gridlock Sam, you know, like not to mention inventing the word gridlock is like, you know, his ideas have, you know, really, you know, come to the forefront and we get to think about them mm-hmm. really differently. But then there's other things, like right now is a good time to think about how cities function in that way, and that maybe we can get rid of cars. And, you know, Gridlock Sam was proposing in the 70s that there shouldn't be cars on, you know, I think it was weekdays or weekends. There was like, there are different like times where there would just be no cars in Manhattan, all these sort of notions that the people went pretty far and then reexamined them. But there's also, you know, like a lot of people, like I was talking to somebody from Houston, and a lot of people in Houston right now, like because of the pandemic, they're spread out lifestyle bubble car, you know, like, you know, 3,000 square foot house lifestyle seems like a great choice in a pandemic because they can be in a bubble and they can never contact people. And they're saying like, see, all you urbanists were making fun of us for, or criticizing us for our choices, but our choices right now are really good. And the thing is like, you never know how this stuff is going to go, you know, and, you know, we were reaching a point, I think a critical point, you know, like in LA, you know, like I think the public transit was going in the direction I like to see, you know, there was more public transit. When I go down there, I ride the public transit. I like it. I'd love to see more people do it. And now it's not a safe time to be on public transit, you know? And so I think it really hit that, that momentum, and it'll take a while for it to come back. But you know, all I can tell you is it'll keep changing. and the main thing is to know where you, why you made the decisions, like what decisions were made for you, and that it really is flexible, and cities are what we make them. You know, they really are. So it's worth looking at them and seeing how we got to where we are so that you can change them in the future.
And there's a great section in here that I just loved. It's all about design by government mandate again, and talks about the role that rules and regulations, even taxes, play in the shape of buildings and in some cases entire city skylines. Tell us a little about that.
So this thing that you can think of, like if you picture Paris, other than picturing like the Arc de Triomphe or the Eiffel Tower, you probably picture a building with like a mansard roof, which is like the roof line is lower than the top of the building. So there's it begins to slope back, and then there's this dormer, this little window that pops out of the roof. And we think of it as like what, you know, it's beautiful French architecture, you know. But the reason why that is the way it is because there was a certain point where there was a difference in taxes depending on how high your building was. And if you could prove that the roof line was this high, you pay taxes, and then the people would still want the space. And so they would add an attic room, which wasn't really, it was above the roof line. It was, and it created that dormer and that shape, and that mansard roof became fashionable. It was sort of, it spread out into the world, which didn't have those tax implications that made it exist in the first place. But there are all kinds of things like this. Like there used to be a brick tax in England. And so the number of bricks you had in your house was how much tax you paid. And so therefore, bricks got really big because they wanted to charge less in taxes, be responsible for less taxes because they had fewer bricks. And then eventually like the taxes caught up and said it was okay, the size of the brick was what mattered. And so it went back down. So you can map, you know, like the era of a building in parts of England based on the size of the bricks, because it reflected the taxes of the time.
Yeah, it even makes me think of here in Los Angeles how city regulations until very recently have made for an extremely dull skyline, because there was this law in the books that said that every building over so many stories had to have a flat roof and a helipad for emergency responders to land on, which is why you don't see anything like a Chrysler building or a Transamerica building in Los Angeles, apparently.
I did not know that. I mean, one of the reasons why you see like a, you know, like the shape of the Empire State Building was because it was supposed to be a mooring tower for Zeppelins to go on, because it was built in this time period where Zeppelins were going to be the way that we got around. And it, you know, I still lament the loss of the Zeppelin in the world, but the shapes of buildings are, you know, like we often think that they're just about art. They're just about, you know, fashion, but they there were tons of considerations that went into the design of things. And that's just one of the ways they're delightful.
By the way, I mentioned the Transamerica building. I have to ask you about that, because right there in your backyard of San Francisco, I think of it as this most iconic symbol of the city, like right up there with the Golden Gate Bridge and Alcatraz. But I never knew until I read this book how controversial it is. There are tons of people, including architects, who absolutely hate that building.
Hated it.
What is the problem with the Transamerica building?
Well, hated it more then than they do now. So one of the big problems with the Transamerica pyramid at the time was that it was sort of erected during the height of modernism. So if you think of like a modern skyscraper, it's this sort of like a cereal box with graph paper put on it. It's like it's a square building. It's glass. It's like it's like there's no wasted space. There's no fussy ornamentation. It just does its job and it's clean and it looks good. And it was a type of modernism that was fashionable at the time. Well, the Transamerica Pyramid is like the opposite of that. Even though it has like modern construction in terms of its concrete and stuff, it has this pyramid at the top. So there's 200 feet of functionless space just to finish out the shape of the pyramid. And modernist architects just thought it was like insulting, you know, like it was like really like they were offended by its existence. And also it has these sort of awkwardness to make it work. Like if you notice, it's not like a true pyramid. It has these little ears that stick out from it, you know, like, and one side of it is the elevator tower and one side of it is stairs. And, you know, so it's not an elegant shape of a pyramid. It has these weird little additions and they're just like, why, if you're going to make it a pyramid, make it a pyramid. If you're going to make it this like monstrosity, it's like, then let it go. You know, they just were offended by its existence. Also, it was like, it was in a neighborhood of North Beach, which was all like three-story Victorians. Like there was no other building like it. And really, it was really the first to really change the character of that neighborhood. So there were all these reasons why architects and neighborhood groups just hated the thing. And it was also like the effort itself was like the Transamerica company really wanted to make an icon. They wanted to make it their logo. You know, so when you're talking about your city, you're like, why should a city be subject to some company's logo? You know, like, but in the end it goes up. People see how it interacts with the city. It becomes a symbol of the city. One of the things that's really great about it is like if you look down Columbus Avenue, it really creates this sort of like perspective of look of a vanishing point perspective. It's really kind of lovely and dramatic. And eventually people just get used to it and it becomes part of the city. And people soon forget that the AIA opposed it. And then later on, you know, like 25 years later, they say it's the best building in the city. So it just happens that way.
Well, before we go, one thing that fans of the show know about you is that you're a man who is vexed by vexology. And in particular, ugly municipal flags are the bane of your existence. I wonder, you've been at this for a while. Have you started to appreciate them yet? Is it a little bit like a John Waters movie? Is there a certain beauty in the hideousness? Can a flag be so bad that it becomes beautiful?
Well, I do think that's true. They can become so bad they become beautiful. The main thing with the city flags was my assertion was that I liked city flags. I liked to see them like with the way it's used really well in Chicago and DC. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't see your city flag, it's because your city flag was probably poorly designed and people, you know, didn't like it. And so there was this sort of like call to arms, redesign your city flags or take out your ugly flag and just put it out there. And if it's yours, you love it. And that's great. And it was kind of a combination of both. And what I've been proud to see is there's been like 200 redesigns of municipal city flags as people have been thinking about this more and more. And I know this because I get written a note about every single one of them when it happens. I get the emails and the tweets about it. I mean, one of the ones in the example in the TED talk that I gave was Milwaukee. And Milwaukee to me, you know, it ranks really poorly. It's a big old mess of all these different symbols. It was put together, you know, very strangely to please everybody, and it's sort of great. But as I've looked at it more and more and more, I'm like, I'm kind of used to it. It's kind of charming in its ugliness. And so that one has grown in my esteem over time, for sure.
It grew on you. Well, let your freak flag fly, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
Again, this book is called The 99% Invisible City, A Field Guide to the Hidden World of Everyday Design. You can also listen to 99% Invisible wherever you listen to podcasts or at 99%invisible.com. Roman Mars, thanks for coming back. This was great.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Roman Mars for returning to the podcast. Order his book, The 99% Invisible City, A Field Guide to the Hidden World of Everyday Design, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. You can listen to 99% Invisible wherever you listen to podcasts or at 99%invisible.com.
Follow Roman and the show on Twitter at RomanMars and at 99pi.org. And be sure to check out the whole lineup of Radiotopia podcasts at radiotopia.fm. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.